Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. I'm Norman Cook, also known as Fatboy Slim, and you're listening to House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hi everyone, and welcome to season 2 of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. We are back, people. Have you missed us? I know a lot of you have been asking where we've been the past few months, and the answer is pulling together a plethora of icons from the world of house music, all for your listening pleasure. If you thought season 1 was good, just wait until you hear who we've got in store across these upcoming episodes. You will not be disappointed. And if you've only just discovered house culture and want to know what we're all about, as I always say, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Come follow us on Instagram at houseculturenet, where you'll get a daily dose of all things related to this scene we know and love. Also, if this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome aboard. And don't forget to dig through our back catalogue of episodes, where you'll find interviews with the likes of Greg Wilson, Johnson Trencher, Terry Farley, Danny Clockwork, and many more. Are you ready to kick off season 2? Let's go! In this episode, I'm so proud to say that we chat to Fatboy Slim, Mr. Norman Cook. This mighty dubcat has not only had a hand in some of the most iconic dance music tracks from the past 30 years, he's also recently sold out arenas with his huge stage show, and he still loves to keep it real by jumping behind the decks at clubs of any size all over the world. As you'll hear, we caught up with Norm just as the coronavirus crisis was ramping up, but we did get a chance to uncover the story behind his first dance floor epiphany.
In that moment, I got the soulfulness of the music and I got the feeling of togetherness that you get in those days at a club, and that collective euphoria just pissed all over me being a kind of hip-hop purist.
Understand how a dance floor can really influence its own behaviour behind the decks?
The really joyful bit is when it actually becomes a conversation of, I'll do something and that will give them so much joy that they start doing something that gives me tons of joy, and you just get this vicious circle of like, how, you know, how stupid can we get, or how deranged can we get, or how sexy can we get.
And learn the reason why he was born to become a DJ.
Me, when I hear a tune I like, I can only enjoy it by sharing it with other people. For some reason, that's the way I get my kicks out of music. Those kind of people, that's why we become a DJs.
So, let's praise this legend like we should. This is Norman Cook.
House Culture.
Right, I'm sat here in a beachfront property in Brighton, which can only mean one thing, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, but sat opposite me right now is none other than Fatboy Slim himself, Mr. Norman Cook.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting us into your home.
That's
to
all
chat.
Right. Thanks for coming. Thanks for caring.
You're welcome. You're an absolute megastar has played a part amongst many music scenes, but for the purpose of this chat, we want to investigate the dance music part of your career. Can you tell us how did you first discover house music and repetitive beats?
Oh, it's a long story. I could waffle on for hours. I'd been DJing for years. First of all, just playing sort of new wave and punk records when I was 15. And then there was this whole kind of electronic, alternative electronic scene when I moved down to Brighton in the very early 80s. And it was kind of early hip hop records, but mixed with like the Clash and Susie and the Banshees, and then that sort of morphed into the sort of new romantic-y stuff and sort of electro, the early kind of electro stuff like Human League, and yeah, it was kind of a little bit of everything. There was nothing sort of unifying it, and then the Rare Groove. I was quite big on Rare Groove. So I was that kind of DJ. I came more from the side, blacker, funkier side of it.
Yeah.
But in the midst of that, there was these tunes coming out of America. I remember This Brutal House by Nitro Deluxe and things like that. And these sort of weird tunes that were kind of like electro records, but kind of had this kind of 4/4 disco feel to them. And I must confess, I wasn't actually that knocked out by them. I thought they sounded a bit... they didn't work funky enough for me. I kind of liked stuff slower and more black, basically. And then at this time I ran off and joined the Circus. I moved up to Hull and joined a band called the House Martins, which is a very white pop, indie pop band.
Yeah.
And which I kind of felt was more my destiny growing up in, you know, white suburbia. You know, I didn't feel like I could, you know, I'd be playing these records made by people, you know, out of the projects in New York, and it kind of felt a little bit of sort of white middle class guilt that I wasn't, you know, that wasn't really me. So the House Martins, and it was mates, you know, Paul was a mate of mine from school. So yeah. Went off and did that, and that was like 85 to 88. And 88 in Hull, where I lived, there wasn't much going on really in the sort of club scene, and I was sort of travelling a lot with the band. So, but then when I moved back to Brighton in 88, something very, very strange had happened to all my friends. They were all wearing bandanas and going, "I see," and telling me to get right on one, matey. And I was quite bemused at first. The first summer I was back, I just thought, and then that was the summer of kind of you know, we call it acid, and
yeah,
the all these house records. And I just thought, I didn't really get it at first. And I really liked my rap music and my funk music. So I kind of stayed DJing. I went back to DJing, like, you know, what I kind of felt best. And there was the odd record that really turned me on. But as a whole, I just thought, and also it was kind of, you know, when anything's at its peak.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, the sun are banging on, you know, 1 minute they're saying, ban these evil acid house barons, and then they're selling you smiley t-shirts, and it's all a bit kind of, you know, yeah, contrived. And so I didn't really, but then one night some friends of mine took me to Boyzone, did a do at Butlin's in Bognor, just up the road from us, and it's a weekender and all my mates were going, so I thought I'd go. And I had an epiphany which later found out Darren Emerson was responsible for. But I didn't know it at the time, but all I knew was that I had a cheeky pill and I was enjoying myself, and just at the moment when I was feeling this kind of community on the dance floor for the first time. I'd never really gone on the dance floor at a house event before. I'd normally just be at the bar, just you know, go, okay, but I was sort of involved and very loved up, and just this wave came over me with Robert Owens singing I'll be your, and it was really kind of turning me on, and all that kind of hairs going on the back of my neck. And it just went on and on. It was just like, I'll be here, I'll be here. And I was thinking, how long is this going to go on? And I, go on, hit me with the drop. And then he went, I'll be your friend. And the whole place just erupted. We all started hugging each other. And it was just a moment. And I'll never forget that moment. And yeah, it was, I just, in that moment, I got the soulfulness of the music. And I got the feeling of togetherness that you would get in those days at a club. And that sort of collective euphoria just pissed all over me being a kind of hip-hop purist. And so that was it. Yeah. And it's funny because I've told that story a few times, and then one day Darren Emerson said to me, you do realize that, no, that I've just realized that was me DJing, and I had two copies of I'll Be Your Friend, and I was just, it did go on as long
no
as you
way.
Thought it was. He said I did it for like about a minute and a half, just everybody was waiting for it to come in. So and in those days it was quite a sort of a small and knit group of those who really loved and understood music.
Yeah.
Which is a very powerful thing in those days. And it was lovely because I was kind of welcomed into the fold. All the people who I'd maybe sneered at were just like, oh, yeah, come on.
Now you get
come
it.
Come on, and now
yeah.
you get it.
I mean, like you said, hearing those early records as well, not in that environment, they can sound quite clinical and cold, I suppose, but once you hear them on a sound system and everyone's around you and it's more feeling that you get, that's where the home is for, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that old cliche of house is a feeling. It is. And it's not just the music, it's where you listen to it and what frame of mind and what ears you hear it with.
So, I mean, at that point, was it okay, as much as you were a hip-hop purist, like you said, were you like, I need to ditch my record collection and get out there and start playing this new stuff? Or, because you're kind of famous for the eclecticism and blending things together, did you think, this is something I can build into my sets?
It sort of crept into my sets slowly. No, I didn't become a sort of overnight convert, because also at that point I would have been in either Beats International or Freak Bar, both of them kind of playing, you know, sort of a different end of the music spectrum. No, it was my love first, and I didn't go out and buy all the records and start house DJing, because I figured the house DJs did it so much better than me, you know, and they'd been doing it for a couple of years, and they'd, you know, so I kind of felt like, well, it's not, you know, I like it, but in a way, a lot of times in my career, the music I like most is the stuff I'm not involved in. Okay. Because there's a definite thing that once music becomes your job, it can become your job.
Yeah.
And it's like I got to a point where most dance music that I listen to, if I listen to a really good tune, rather than listen to it simply for the enjoyment of it, I just think, why didn't I think of that? Or how can I incorporate that idea into what I do? Or how did they do that? You know, and I would just listen to it analytically and professionally, rather than the sheer joy. So at first, house music, it wasn't what I did for a living, so I could just enjoy it naturally and with my friends, and it would be a night off for me, and I wouldn't be checking out the DJ the whole time. I'd actually just be enjoying myself. But then that slowly over the next couple of years, I then tentatively attempted make it. I think so. A mate of mine got me to do a remix of a house record, Fidel Fatty. They just want to. It was Esther B. Pleasure of the Dance.
All right, yeah.
And they said, "Oh, do you want to do this?" It was around the time of Black Box, and they're like, "Can you make this into another Italian disco crossover smash?" And I was like, "I don't really do. You know, I'm not au fait with house music." And they went, "Oh, you must be able to." So I had a go, and I sort of enjoyed it. But again, I didn't want to sort of reinvent myself as making house music. But just gradually, I put out some Mighty Dubcats records, which were sort of...
Yeah, I mean, like, you're kind of famous for having many different names in terms of, like, Pizza Man, Mighty Dubcats, you know, Beer and Beats International, Freak Power, etc. Like, were all of those kind of created just to service a different... scratch a different itch in terms of the genres you were...
A bit of that. A bit of it was sort of contractual.
Yep.
Because, so by this point, I'm definitely in Freak Power. So I'm signed to Iron and Records as a recording act, and they've given me an advance, which means my arse is theirs.
Yeah.
And so, but I was allowed to put out, I was allowed to put out 12-inch records on independent labels under false names, as long as I never admitted they were me. So that was gave me an outlet. But no, more than just sort of contractually, it was, it meant I could tentatively put out house records without people going, because by then I'd got quite a name for myself as a remixer and as a DJ.
Yeah.
And, you know, people weren't going, Judas, he's sold out, he's made a house record, or the house people weren't going, he's trying to jump on the house bandwagon. So I just kind of tentatively put out records out that people didn't know were me. And gradually, I think it wasn't until Pizza Man that I actually nailed it. The first few... Yeah. Mighty Dubcats records were interesting, but they weren't proper floor fillers.
Yeah.
But with Pizza Man, I sort of nailed it. And I was sort of helped along at that point by my friends who ran Loaded Records, with JC and Tim, and at that time, Roger Wildchild.
Mm.
And so they sort of coached me into making house records, coaxed and coached me, actually. And so I kind of gradually sort of wormed my way in. And then one day I was on some dreadful tour around Europe with Freak Power, playing to like 37 people, and like thinking, you know, when I DJ, and then watching like Mighty Dubcats records be in the charts and Pizza Man records be in the charts, thinking, what the hell am I doing here, pretending to be a guitarist and a songwriter when, you know, my first love was always that. And so that was when I kind of threw in my lot. with trying to be in bands and be a pop star. And I just, you know, realised that I'm a much better DJ than I'm a bass player.
So that was the moment where you were like, okay, I'm giving up on the band
yeah.
kind of shtick and going full on DJ. What year was that?
That would have been about 95 or 96, I think. Yeah. I was already making Fatboy records. At that point, I was Fatboy Slim, Pizza Man, The Mighty Dubcats and Freak Power. And it was fun, but exhausting.
Yeah.
And something had to go, and I decided touring with Freak Power and just, you know, in terms of logistics and finances, it was a no-brainer. Like I said, I could pay to 50 people in some god-awful club in Dusseldorf.
Yeah.
Or I could, you know, play to, you know, there'd be queues around the block to play in Brighton at the Boutique or something like that.
Yeah.
So that was when we started the Boutique.
Yeah.
And that was, though by this point I'd kind of sort of moved on from house a bit.
Yeah.
Big Beat was like kind
of, I mean, that was the thing, you know, that whole Big Beat scene, can I say it was born down here in Brighton at the Boutique?
No, it spread virally very quickly. There was an outpost in Brighton. No, it was sort of born in London. It was born at the Heavenly Social.
Oh, the Heavenly Social, yeah, of course.
Way more kind of Tom and Ed and Richie Fearless and John Carter and those people.
Yeah.
But I was doing it in Brighton, and then Lindy Layton, who'd been the singer of Beats International, she just phoned me up and said, you know that kind of weird mix of music you play, which is like sort of hip-hop records speeded up and acid house records slowed down, and I went, yeah, there's people doing it in London, you know, you should come up and see. So she took me to the Social and I met Tom and Ed, and we were just like, ah, kindred spirits.
Brilliant.
But we were always Brighton was always this southern branch.
I mean, and was that, did you feel like, great, this is something I can really get my teeth into now, having coming from like a hip-hop world, heavily sample culture, is this something I can bring into the dance music community?
Yeah, I mean, the whole part, Big Beat sounds a little bit kind of naff now, looking back, but at that moment it was like we'd all liked hip-hop, but then it got a bit too gangster. We'd all grown up listening to the Beatles, and most of us of that age group had grown up through punk. And punk had revolutionised the music business in the way of, like, you don't need to be a proper musician to start a band.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a proper record label. You know, you just press the records yourself. So we had that DIY ethic. We had the sort of pop background. Then we'd been into hip-hop. Then we'd got into acid house. And then we were getting acid house. I mean, house had gone a bit handbaggy at that point. It was a little bit dull. And so we're like, right, rather than trying to invent a new genre, it's like, let's take the previous four, take the best bits out of the previous four and sort of mash them up. And I don't think it was a conscious decision to make music like that. For me, it was just to DJ, just to be more eclectic in my DJing.
Yeah.
But then when Lindy took me out, and when I met John Carter and the Chemical Brothers and the Kahuna Brothers, it was just like, we felt like kindred spirits. It was like, there's something going on here. And every week there was more and more people coming in. But like punk and like acid house, we felt like we were kind of changing the parameters slightly within the music business.
Yeah, completely. I mean, a lot of the things you were looking back to and sampling were things that had never been kind of brought into that music ever before. Did you feel like it was a great excuse to go back and raid a lot of good stuff from your record collection?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. I mean, that was the thing about Big Beat. The whole idea of it was just break all the rules of fashion, taste, behaviour, everything. But then sort of 2 or 3 years on, we sort of became the rules, and Big Beat Records became formulaic, which was exactly what they weren't supposed to be, which is why we kind of moved on fairly quickly.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was definitely, we definitely felt we've got our own little thing here. But it was like there's no dress code on this one, you know. All previous kind of movements, there was, you know, this one could just exist anywhere and you wouldn't know who we were until you put the right record on, and then we'd all start misbehaving.
What was that final party? I swear I've seen footage of you guys smashing the whole place up with a hammer. You just take it to pieces?
Yeah, well, the original premises, which is right by the pier in Brighton, the original Concord, it was like a kind of scout hut kind of thing, and it used to serve teas to old ladies in the afternoon, and then was just, it's a little venue in the evening. And we'd been there probably 3 years, and the place was getting redeveloped, so they were knocking the place down, and they asked me to play the last ever set there. So I was like, okay. I just said to the owner, I said, can I take a little piece of the dance floor home with me, because this has been, you know, our clubhouse, this has been our cavern club, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, can I take a little piece of dance floor home? He said, bring tools. He said, you can take whatever you want, it's going to get demolished in the morning. So I brought tools. We brought a sledgehammer and saws and jemmies and things, and we took the club apart whilst DJing. And my favourite moment, there was a big pillar in the middle of the stage holding the thing up. They'd always been there. And at one point I was DJing with one hand and soaring through this pillar with the other. And then one of the bouncers came running up going, no, which they very rarely said no to most things that I did in there. But he's like, no. I was like, no, it's all right. Chris said I could do it, and he went, no, that's where the power lines are. Oh, no. So, yeah, that's the only thing held us back, was a tiny amount of health and safety.
Wow. And so that during that era, obviously, as well, you released Better Living Through Chemistry, Come a Long Way Baby, you know, Halfway Between the Gutter and the Stars, kind of, you know, three classic albums of that kind of sound. At that point, did you think, okay, Big Beat's kind of done, like you said it almost sounded a bit cliche. What was the next step then for you as an artist?
I don't know, confusion. I mean, if you listen to Halfway Between the Gutter and the Stars, it's gone back to house.
Yeah.
But with a kind of no holds barred, no rules house. Yeah. So, and around that time, I think just house music started to turn me on. I think everybody had realised that the handbaggy sound had got a bit too samey. Then the Big Beat backlash happened, and luckily, kind of me and Tom and Ed had sort of, we'd plotted a year before, it's like, let's get off this one so we don't go down with the ship. Yeah. So we'd sort of moved back into the house, and it's always been, I mean, that house beat, whether you call it house or you call it disco, it goes right back to, you know, tribal. It's just a tribal thing. Yeah. So it's always going to be there, and it's always going to have the capacity to turn you on. And it's like an old friend who'll always welcome you back. You can stray from the fold, you come back, but it's always there, and it'll always go, oh, I come on in. Then you finish messing with the other people, have you come back in?
And you said that listening to music now, you kind of sometimes analyse things. And is there anything of stuff from that era that you hear back now and you're kind of like, oh, I wish I'd done that, or I'd changed that, or I'm really proud of that? Or is it just, it's just out there and you just kind of forget about it and it is what it is?
I think most of the stuff I do, I try to never listen to again. Because if you do, you always think, oh, I should have done that or that. But luckily, the only ones I have to listen to were the really good ones. And those ones are kind of, no, there's no glaring bits that I wish I'd done differently. I mean, obviously, in terms of my overall music career, there's a thousand things that I would have done differently with the benefit of hindsight. But you can't get hung up on that.
No.
I could quite easily do my own head in. Just go, oh, funny. I only unsaid, you know, things I've said as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, in my younger days, I was a bit more opinionated and headstrong, and possibly had a head full of vodka. And I've said things over the things that I've... I think I've probably regretted more things that I've said rather than records that I've made or clothes that I've worn. So I've got two... One out of three isn't bad.
I want to talk to you about the Ibiza silent movie that came out last year, described as the loudest silent movie you could produce. Obviously, you curated the soundtrack for that.
Yeah.
But kind of before we come on to that element of it, can you tell us about your first experiences in Ibiza? What were those days like for you?
My very first one was really cool, but also at the same time really not cool. So 1987, I'm on holiday in Ibiza with my then first wife, just because it was the cheapest. We wanted a summer holiday, and it was the cheapest one we could find as a package. And we were staying in Sanam Bay in a really, really rubbish hotel where the house band was a Chaz and Dave covers band. But we were just lying in the sun all day listening to Gurcher and Rabbit all night. And one night we're like, oh, we should really get out of Sanam Bay. Yeah. And, you know, see some of the sights. And there was this, you know, Ibiza Old Town. So we got this bus over to Ibiza Old Town. And this is where it gets bad. Bumped into two old friends of mine from that I used to play football with in charity football matches, which were Christopher Quentin and Gary Davis. Now, I knew them both just through my previous showbiz life.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm just on there. And I said, what are you doing there? And I was going out clubbing. I was going, I didn't know there was clubs on this island. They went, oh, yeah, there's this really good club called Pasha. Have you not heard of it? I went, no. He said, yeah, there's something crazy going on in there. We were there the last couple of nights, and yeah, people are going, man, I think they're on drugs or something. So I was like, sounds fun. So they took me, Gary Davis and Christopher Quentin took me to Pasha and got me in free. And that was my first taste of proper Ibiza nightlife, you know, outside just like the kind of Brit bars in Sanam Bay. Yeah, and I was like, wow, this is quite interesting. But then at that point, here's where, yeah, because at that point I wasn't a house DJ, so I didn't DJ there.
Yeah.
For the next few years. And it wasn't until Manumission invited me and Carter to go over to play the back room. Because at that point, yeah, I wasn't a house DJ. And in fact, pretty much all I play now is house. So that probably came from playing in in Ibiza, where once I was getting put on in the main room, I kind of had to play house all night, and so I got better at it. I took it more seriously.
Yeah, and isn't Gary Davis, I swear he's credited as the first person not to break 808 State Pacific on Radio 1
I must have been living that life. Gary Davis, so you said, I mean, you can say what you want about some of the clothes he might have worn during the 80s, but no, he genuinely loved his music, and he did break a lot of the cool. I mean, you have to remember, in those days, dance music or black music or club music was never played on the radio.
Yeah.
Or John Peel might play it after 10 o'clock, but it was never played on mainstream radio. So you never hear these records. So in a way, Gary Davis was the conduit, that he would go out clubbing with his showbiz mates, and he'd hear these records and he'd put them on his show at, you know, lunchtime on Radio 1, which is unheard of. And he broke quite a lot. Him and Peter Powell, though history might not remember them fondly, they did break a lot of club records, because to the rest of us living in Red Hill, we would never heard those records because there wasn't a nightclub in Red Hill that would play them. And so it was, there was a big, they were kind of the Pete Tong, as Pete Tong was to a later generation. They were the only ones translating what you would hear in the clubs to what you'd actually hear on Radio 1. So big up Gary Davis.
And in terms of Ibiza generally now, obviously you were there back then in 87, pre-Summer of Love. What are your thoughts on kind of that journey that it's taken, your whole journey through Ibiza over the years?
Well, it's been fabulous. Since then, I've lived half my life quite literally there. I've met Zoe there. I go there on holiday with my kids every single year. My son's 19. He's been there every year of his life. And I've watched him from, you know, going there inside his mother's tummy to now he's clubbing. He'll probably be getting a DJ slot within the next 2 years. I bet he'll get himself a slot DJing. So it's a whole generation, and it's a place where I've fallen in love, lost, got high, got low, everything, you know. And and also musically, it's been so important for DJs, because it just, again, it would tie things in, you know. Radio 1 would come there and they would, you know, turn more people onto what was going on there. And yeah, because I met Zoe because I was on her show on Radio 1. That was the only way that they could work out and getting me on the breakfast show.
Yeah.
Was to bring the breakfast show to Ibiza and me to go there straight from the clubs, because I couldn't get up early enough to go to the breakfast show unless I'd been out the night before. It's a very spiritual place for me, and but it's everything. It's kind of a family place as well as a place to rave, and I've got so many friends on the island, and that all tied, you know, doing the soundtrack to the film just cemented my relationship with it even more.
Yeah, so it's kind of putting that together, did you feel a lot of pressure in terms of picking the right tracks, or was it just approaching like a DJ set?
It was a bit of both. There was a bit of wanting it to work to tell the story. I've always wanted to get involved in film soundtracks, because I love a good film. I love a good, well-made film. And I love the mechanics of storytelling. It's a bit like a DJ set. You're trying to present something. And music can be so vital to a film soundtrack. It can just be so evocative, or, you know, just heighten a scene or establish a mood or something. So I was really interested in the way that I could help tell the story with the music, which was handy because we had no dialogue. Because tons of people, when I was doing it, they went, well, guys, how do you hold it all together with no dialogue? Because normally the music fits around that and it augments it. And in a way, luckily we had the subtitles and the graphics, but they only came near the end. Before, it was trying to tell a story. So yeah, I put an awful lot of thought and work into it. At the same time, I kind of wanted to be an ambassador for Ibiza, because there was, at first, I wanted to have all the music was made by people who either had lived on or had a strong connection. They've spent summers playing there or what. And there was tons of people going through the rock bands that used to live there or record there and stuff. So I went through trying to go through the history, and also Julian Temple, the director, he's a fabulously clever and witty man, but he'd never been to Ibiza before the film. So I had to kind of tell him a lot of the backstory.
Yeah.
And it was good for him to come and do it, because he didn't get caught up in some of the cliches that the rest of us.
He had that fresh pair of eyes.
Yeah, he had a fresh pair of eyes, but he needed me as his ears.
Yeah.
So, and that was quite different. And then, but then at the end of the day, and I'm saying this for all the house purists who are listening, at the end of the day, the politics and the finances of making a film soundtrack with that amount of music on meant we couldn't afford most of the tunes that I wanted. So if you listen to it, there's a few tunes you'd go, oh, that sounds a little bit like Loretta Now. And it was basically a cheap copy of it because we couldn't afford the original. So there was a lot of pivotal tunes that I couldn't get in. And there was a lot of there were a couple where I insisted. But I mean it when it started, I'm sure Julian wouldn't mind me telling him, when it started, the opening titles were the Venga Boys going to Ibiza. And I saw this, the first bit I saw, I went, right, okay, Julian, you need me here. You need to know that this record has never been played on the island of Ibiza.
Yeah.
It's played by idiots around the rest of the Costa Brava, and it would never be played on the island, and it's just wrong and naff, and the Venga Boys would be lynched if they ever tried to go to Ibiza. And he's like, really? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay. And he, bless him, it did take 3 or 4 months of me having pointing this out. I'd see another rough cut. It's like, you still got the Venga Boys on the opening credits, Julian. This is good. So so there's just things like that.
Yeah.
Things like that. And just knowing which tunes. But then things like Gibbero and things like that, to get them in, he would have never known about that tune in a million years and wouldn't know what it means to people who've been there for a long time. So it was great. But I'd just like to apologise to all the people who... not apologise to the people who wouldn't do us, cut us any deals.
And it premiered at Glastonbury as well, a place, again, that's very special to you. Obviously, you've played... How many times have you played there? How many different places have you played in Glastonbury, would you say?
I've played all the major stages over the years, and I've played every year that it's been on since 96.
Wow.
Yeah, which I think... I can't do the maths. But it's a lot, yeah.
And what's your, if you can remember any, highlight, preference of place to play? Obviously, everything's different.
It's all good. That's what I love about Glastonbury. It's everywhere you go, there's something funny going on and there's somebody beautiful to meet and talk to and get to know. And it can be from all walks of life. And I've been lucky enough that I can trawl round. I've had fabulous evenings in the Rabbit Hole and the Blues Shack is great. But at the same time, I've been lucky enough to play on the other stage. We did it in the John Peel tent the other year. That was really, really took the roof off. I mean, one year I actually did a tour of Glastonbury tour, where we played 6 shows over 4 days.
Yeah.
And all in different, big, small. And it's lovely because everyone is different, but it's still got that kind of unifying Glastonbury abandon.
Yeah.
And, lack of pretension and just kind of no nonsense. Let's see how much we can make each other smile. And so I'm lucky that I haven't always just been in Silver Haze or in the Shangri-La. I can literally dot about, with my little backpack with my laptop, my headphones on my back, and I just yomp around.
Can I play? And is it true? I swear it's probably
whatever you're about to say. Yes, probably.
That you don't take any payment from any gigs for Glastonbury.
Yes.
Yeah, do it gratis.
That was only because I did it 1 year, and then I think they just thought, oh, bless him, he doesn't need to get. I didn't realise I was supposed to get paid. I just thought he did it for free. I thought he did it for the love. Wow. But I mean, most of the side gigs you do for the love anyway.
Yeah.
But I kind of, on the one hand, I think it was Glastonbury who leaked that I never cashed the checks. But I would counter that Glastonbury have given me a healthy guest list of all my family and friends who we go as a little gang. And they've always given us tickets every year, whether or not I'm officially on the bill. They know I'm going to turn up anyway and play somewhere, in Block 9. So they give me an allocation of tickets every year, and I will thank them forever for that.
They don't want you turning up and playing and then you charging them for it.
No, I think they... For me, it was that's the reason I played every year, because I think if 1 year they didn't give me... they said, you've got to buy a ticket this year. I'd figure that's their way of saying, Norman, you can't just turn up and play every single year. But they always have, so I figured it is all right for me to go back and play there.
There you go, and you're playing there this year.
This year I'm officially on the bill, yeah. I'm not sure... A, by the time you hear this podcast, A, whether Glastonbury will still be on, or B, whether it'll have been announced yet, but this year I'm actually on the official bill.
Fantastic. And you're also involved in a Sweet Harmony exhibition at the Saatchi Gallery last year.
Not so much.
Did you DJ at the party?
I played at a party of the closing night with Carl for my charity, and they were generous enough to donate the closing party to be a ticketed charity show for us.
Great.
But I wasn't involved in the curation of that art show. But I do have a penchant for art curation these days?
Just was trying to lead up to, but
I like it. Nice segue there. Okay, I like what you did there.
I suppose there's two prongs on that. Is
why
the back-to-back aspect of playing with Carl Cox?
Oh yeah.
I suppose who do you love playing back-to-back with? How do you approach doing that? And is it a case of working together or kind of a one-upmanship?
It's a bit of all of them. It's a bit of all of the above. Currently, there's only two DJs that I back-to-back with. Mm. One is Carl and the other is Dan Eats Everything. Mm-hmm. And it's because I trust them and because I know that we kind of have a similar mindset and we know where we're going and we know it'd be good. Because the trouble with back-to-backing is just over the years, it's just become... It's kind of a way of putting two more names on the flyer. And some of them are interesting and some of them productive. Some of them, it just felt like they were glued together for the sake of it, or it's some kind of weird jousting competition. Now, for me, DJing was never meant to be competitive. It's not a competitive sport. But having said that, if there's someone you know well enough, you are always egging it. You know, when it works, I mean, and I've done it over the years, I'm not hoard about too much. But I used to do it with Armin van Helden. Mm-hmm. And we definitely used to spar each other. It would be like, okay, see that? I'll raise you that. And you go, okay, I'll see you and I'll raise you that. And it does, it makes you up your game. And it really, you know, there's that good element of competition. But I've heard tales of DJs trying to screw each other over. And it's just like no one wins. It's like for the crowd, they want to see either two people who know each other well and work in harmony, or two people who are sparring each other off to make a better show, but for them, not for self-indulgence and not for their own jousting, you know, bragging rights. Or like, I fucked him up. So yeah, it's a weird beast back-to-backing. But like I said, Carl and Dan are the only people I kind of know and trust well enough to do it with them. Yeah. And especially with me and Dan, we do become this kind of sort of comedy techno double act. So he makes me play more techno and I kind of inject a bit more comedy. Actually, there's not quite a lot of comedy in dance sets anyway, but we definitely work well together as a double act.
Yeah, and to talk about your art curation as well, and because you collect smileys, right?
I collect smileys, but I also collect art. I mean, I collect art generally, but particularly smiley art.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've sort of had dalliances with artists. There's an artist called Riker.
Yeah.
Who does a lot of my graphics, and then some of the bigger gigs, he does the merch store, and he actually paints T-shirts with stencils and that. So he makes everyone personalised T-shirts, and we do strange things where we give away smile. We go around the town in the afternoon putting smiley art in places and leaving it for people to find. So I've been having kind of flirtations with artists, and I've sort of become friends with a lot of artists. And one of them was a Portuguese guy called Veals. Mm. And I DJed with him and used some of his visuals in my show, and we were sort of collaborating. And in the midst of that, he said, I've got this gallery in Lisbon. We've got nothing on in July. Do you want to do an exhibition? And I'd never really thought of it before, but it seemed like it might be fun. And it was. It was really good to be walked through it by Veals and his people, and a good friend of mine, Joe Brooks, who kind of walked me through it. But it was really fun. It was kind of using some of my sort of showbiz experience, but also being in a whole different place. But curating it in the way you would a DJ set, you know, just going with on instincts, like, well, I like that, so I like that, and then that might fit together with that, and then that was how I would present it to you. So, and I really enjoyed it, and no one, you know, none of the people at the gallery was like, what the hell are you doing here, you twat, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. The artists all loved, you know, and they didn't mind me saying, oh, can you do that, or make that a bit bigger. So I just enjoyed the relationship with the artists, the relationship with the art world, but most of all, just with the people. I would just spend afternoons just like with a hat on, so no one recognised me, just watching people, watching their reactions, and you know, who was getting the most Instagram clicks. And I just really enjoyed watching people in the way that I enjoy watching people dance. And I like it when I put a record on, everyone goes woo, like that. It gives you a real feel. So it was a kind of art version of that.
Yeah,
and I really enjoyed it. And you know, no one said, you fake what you're doing, or, you know, why are you pissing about in the art world? You know nothing about it. People are like, well, that's really good that you brought a different slant to it and introduced some new artists and work with people. So Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to work with like the London Police, who, those of you who know, London Police, who I really loved, and Veals, and Riker, and Chemical X, and James Joyce. Oh, God, who am I going to forget now and get told off? And so that's something that I could see continuing.
Yeah,
in
so
future.
That's just been a one-off so far.
So far, it's been a one-off. At the time of doing this podcast, again, coronavirus allowing, we are going to be putting a Smiley Art exhibition in the foyer of the Human Traffic Extravaganza at Printworks. Like I said, fingers crossed.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge thing that's going on there, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a month long, isn't it? Is it like every night there's a different...
18 shows, and it's really, really ambitious. Yeah. Really ambitious. There's a kind of an exhibition, sort of ray-based exhibition, and then food trucks, and then an immersive theatrical, all singing, all dancing performance of the film. And then you get your regular Printworks gig after it. And they've kind of got, they've been very reverential, like everyone who's involved in the film, like Carl and me. they've got, tried to get everyone back in, and then they pulled in all the old school DJs who were around 20 years ago when the film came out. And it's amazing how well the film, I mean, I showed my 19-year-old raving son the film a couple of weeks ago. And he was just like, oh, it was like, yep, nothing's changed in 20 years of clubbing.
No.
And it's pretty much the same themes and the same characters you meet.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I was 19 when that film came out, and it's like, that was my life on screen. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, very few films, I think, can capture club culture. No, especially Hollywood films. They have a club scene. You're like, oh, Christ, really? Have you ever been to a nightclub? They're not like that. And that was the first one that actually captured the atmosphere and the culture of clubbing. And yeah, so I'm quite happy to be part of it. Sadly, contractually, I wasn't allowed to DJ. No, just because I was playing Love Box, I couldn't DJ. I can't DJ at the in the after party Printworks thing.
But you're contributing in the
I couldn't publicly play at the after party. Because it was my tune, it was the opening credits of the film, I really wanted to be part of it in some way.
Yeah.
And they have got tons of space and wanted us to do so. Yeah, so we're doing part two of the Smiley exhibition, Smile High Club.
Amazing.
At Printworks, I hope, unless we don't.
Yeah, it's all touch and go, isn't it, I think, at the moment, with a lot of stuff.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Talking about kind of playing live, and you mentioned Lovebox as well, your stage show is like absolutely huge. It's, you know, it's come a long way from the Concorde, two decks now. It's this huge audiovisual experience with confetti cannons and all kinds of stuff going on. Do you think that kind of adds a lot of pressure to you as an artist to deliver that?
Only if I had to do that for a living. Luckily, that's not my living. that's just something we do in the summer when we do the big festivals.
Yeah.
95% of the rest of the shows I do aren't like that at all.
Yeah.
No, the big shows, when we do the big arena shows, we like to throw... And it's fun to do, but I wouldn't want to do it all year round because you're playing big arenas that I don't really feel that. You're trying to inject soulfulness into a, you know, very sanitized environment. And until last year, I'd never knowingly played an arena in my life. But just because I thought, you know, our music doesn't belong in there, or our, you know, club culture. But we can use the bells and whistles and playing in the round. We can use that to break up that and make it feel, and it's like, okay, this isn't, you know, as cozy as your neighborhood club, but it, your neighborhood club can't do this. So but most of the DJing, when you say my show,
yeah
that's just the big show. But then the rest of the time I'm doing just my normal show. And for that yin, there's a yang, which means I was at a dirty Polish tech, I played two sets in one night at a Polish techno club on Friday, and a raving Croatia on Saturday night, and next week I'm playing Watergate. Yeah, so I like the fact that I'm still allowed to play dirty techno clubs.
Yeah,
and get my jollies. And I mean, over the years, it got bigger and bigger because we were just being put on bigger stages, and it got to a point where I'm on a stage and I'm thinking, I've got to do more than just stand there and play records to people. So I started waving my arms around, and that bought me another couple of years. But then it's like, I could do more than stand here. And it came from one night when I did Tea in the Park, and I was headlining over the Foo Fighters. So the Foo Fighters went on beyond me. They've just done their whole kind of show, and, you know, guitar solos, and, you know, and then they got all their gear off, all this gear. They just put a table at the front with two record players on it. And I was like, how the fuck am I going to top that? So we had to raise our game production-wise. Yeah. And around that time, Screens and Serato Video allowed you to start doing more. So, yes, we've tried to make the big show bigger. Yeah. But at the same time, I appreciate the smaller shows more because I can take more risk and have fun. Yeah. The thing is with the big show, I wouldn't say it's rehearsed, but there's certain patterns and certain tunes. Once I've made the visual for a tune, we kind of use it for a year or two.
Yeah.
And so you end up playing the same tunes for a year or two, which is more I want to do wholly for my living. But it works on those bigger stages.
Yeah. And your preference, obviously, you're talking, you know, your face lighting up when you're talking about playing dirty techno clubs in Poland. Like, is it that intimate space where you can see the whites of the eyes of the people that you're playing these records to?
Yeah. But also, it's more of a shared experience. The bigger the stage you are, the more lonely you are up there. Even though there's more people, but you're more lonely. And the biggest stage is you're kind of 20 foot from your own people. You know, you're just, it's a 2 minute walk to the wings. And all you're doing is just being a performing monkey. And you're trying your best to try and project to this huge audience. And it's fun, but it's work. It's hard. I find it quite hard work.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm just in the corner of a nightclub, playing tunes and wandering off at tangents, then that's why I got into this. You know, that's the bit I loved that I got into. And it's the most honest, and I take risks and I play different tunes. You know, I play a way, way more interesting set when I play in a smaller place.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of a lot lowest common denominator. And also I'm having genuine fun, and I'm having more of a rapport with the audience because I can actually see them.
Yeah.
I can touch them. Because you think how far away, those big stages at Creamfields or something like that on the main stage, you're 30 foot from the audience, and it's hard to get any kind of, it's all one sided. It's all just you just giving it the large one, and then somewhere, you know, you're just seeing their hands in the air in the distance. But when you're in a club, it's a two way conversation. It's sometimes quite literally, you know, and I love that, and I thrive on that, and that's how I really get my fun. I mean, that's the bit that I always used to do as a hobby before it became my job. Yeah. And I still like to keep that as a hobby of love rather than a job.
And is it the most joyful experience, or just watching something you're giving to that audience and watching the joy they're experiencing back?
The really joyful bit is when it actually becomes a conversation of, I'll do something and that will give them so much joy that they start doing something that gives me tons of joy. And you just get this vicious circle of like, how stupid can we get, or how deranged can we get, or how sexy can we get, you know? And it just, you get this sort of ongoing thing that they make me play better, and then so then I'll try something new, and then that'll go down, you know. They egg me on, and it's spontaneous.
Yeah.
It's spontaneous, and it's very much a community thing. It's like everyone, it becomes a part of it, Whereas the big shows, it's kind of them and us. It's you on stage and it's them over there.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, like I suppose if you've made the visuals or something, you already go in there with a preconceived notion of those beats you've got to hit. Whereas in a club, if it's that two-way communication, everyone's influencing what you're doing as well as you're influencing what they're doing. Yeah.
And just you can just wander off the beaten path and meander around and see where you end up.
Yeah.
You know, a gig, there's a route and you've got to get from there to there, and there's only one road between there and there. Yeah. This you can just meander, and if you end up over there, it doesn't matter because there was no, you know, you haven't got an encore to hit.
Yeah.
You know, you haven't got the pyro bit. It's like, okay, I've got to get into right here, right now, and time for, you know, and it's a nice satisfaction to pull off a big show and to wow the crowds, but for me that's work.
Yeah.
And DJing at a club is fun.
It's great you've got them both in there. In terms of that eclecticism, you said you can kind of meander and take different routes and whatever. How do you discover that new music right now, and what kind of keeps you inspired anyway? It's like gone are the days really where it's kind of like going into a record shop, it's all kind of shifted online.
I just trawl the net probably 2-3 hours a day on average. I get sent so much stuff. I probably get about 60 tunes a day on weekdays.
You listen to them all?
Yeah, I give them at least 10 seconds.
Yeah.
But obviously if it's drum and bass record or trance record.
Yeah.
But no, I check them all out, and then I just go trawling around Beatport or just following threads around the world. So I'm always on the hunt, and it's not as much fun as hanging around and spending all Wednesday afternoon chatting to other DJs in a record shop and then getting a pile and sitting there listening through them all. But it's I still get the same buzz, because if I have to wade through 400 tunes to get one good one, boy am I happy when I hear that good one. I just still get that buzz, and then I can't wait to play it out, and then it's like, and then when I play it, and then I'll maybe, you know, edit it a bit, and then I'll play it out, and then it's kind of, it's like, oh. And that is the kind of the process, that's the journey's end for me.
Yeah.
Because for me, there's people who, when they hear a record they like, it's like, okay, I'm going to put that on my Spotify playlist, and then I might listen to it on the way to work, and or if they're really into it, I might just sit in my bedroom at home, listen to it on the headphones, you know, over and over again. Me, when I hear a tune I like, I can only enjoy it by sharing it with other people. And it's this weird compulsion that if I hear it, I can't just sit there and just go, yeah, this is really good. I have to tell someone. I have to persuade somebody else that it's really good, or they have to agree with me that it's really good. And for some reason, that's the way I get my kicks out of music. But I mean, that's those kind of people. That's why we become a DJs.
You listen to all of that music. Does when you find that one, does it always jump out at you? You know that that's going to work. Is it just a feeling inside, or?
Yeah, it's just an instinct. And sometimes you listen to it, and then on, you know, a rainy Tuesday afternoon, and you think it's going to work, and then you play it on a big thing, and it doesn't. And then sometimes the one that you weren't quite sure about, it really, when you play it in front of other people really loud, all of a sudden it takes on a different entity. But no, I don't know what the criteria are. And some people, when I tell them about how much I get sent on mailing lists, and they're like, oh, don't you have someone who does that for you? You know, because some DJs apparently have, people sort of, I'm like, I wouldn't trust anybody else to know what, because I don't know what it is that I like.
Yeah.
So I couldn't trust anybody else to pick the records for me. And no, it's just an ear. It's an instinct that I've always had about music that I found that generally tends to work. Whether it's a tune I'm making or DJing for someone else, if I think, ooh, that sounds a bit good, generally I've quite good ears, and I've got quite a good sort of success ratio of knowing when something's good, which I think is probably how I've got away with being a DJ for all these years. So this is not my mixing my mixing abilities, that's for sure. So yeah, I mean, I think there's an instinct that good DJs have you know, and you might not necessarily know what it is. It's just, is it catchy? Does it work? Does it grab you? And you can tell quite instantly, because if you think they're only going to hear it once, not kind of, oh yeah, after 10 listens, this will really get under your skin. It's like, you've got to hit them with that first listen. It's got to be something that, a groove that they just instinctively go with. So I just figure if I instinctively go with it, they probably will, hopefully. That's the extent of the science of it. And it's just putting in the hours, just sitting there, just going through them all.
Wow. And is there a compulsion to create new music at the moment from yourself?
No, absolutely not, sadly. There was.
Yeah.
There was for many years, and it just sort of tailed off. And I don't know if it's just I'm getting old. Some of it's definitely the technology involved. I used to get really turned on by abusing drum machines and synthesizers and seeing where you could, you know, play them wrong. And laptops, everything's kind of there on a plate for you, and you can't overload things, and you can't break rules.
Yeah.
And also, you're just faced with unlimited possibilities and every single synth at your fingertips, and I don't know where to start. So, yeah, the process doesn't turn me on. The idea of making... The thing I like least about the whole music business is trying to sell records to people. Yeah. And once you've made a record, you've then committed to... You've got to do interviews and videos and things like that. And I don't enjoy that bit anymore. I used to.
Yeah.
But I don't enjoy that anymore. And, you know, I look at my kids and I think, have I got anything to say relevant to you? And as a man of my age, am I going to come up with concepts like they know what is what, they don't know what is what, they just struck, what the fuck? You know, my brain doesn't really work like that anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think maybe I'm just getting old. But it might not be forever. At the moment, I'm so turned on by DJing. So turned on by DJing and sharing the music I like and traveling the world and everything, that I just get no pleasure about being in the studio. Last time I made a record, I just really didn't enjoy it. When we Eat, Sleep, Rave, Repeat, it was all right when we first put it out, but then when it got a sniff of the charts, all of a sudden there's all this just sucking corporate dick that, you know, I'm not prepared to do as I get older. Yeah. And making videos, it's like, why do we have to make a video? It's like, because that's what you do when you put a record out. So, so I've fallen out of the record making process and the record selling process.
Mm.
But the playing other people's records process, I love. And it fills up my year. It's not like I'm you know, sitting around scratching my navel, though I might be this summer. With Coachella going down today.
Gone, is it?
Yeah. Well, it's gone back to October.
Oh, no way. Okay.
But yeah, that's the first of what might be many cancellations for me this summer. So maybe this will be the summer I go back into the studio because I've got no other gigs. No, I think I might at one point feel that I'm too old to be traveling around the world and DJing, or I might feel just too old to be a DJ.
Yeah.
And then I might go back in the studio. But at the moment, I'm quite happy as being a DJ.
And you mentioned your 19-year-old son potentially getting a gig in a couple of years in Ibiza or something like that. Do you think, is this a path that you would recommend for him, like looking at it through a father's eyes to your son?
I prefer him to be a DJ and a bloody reality TV star, that's for sure. Bless him. We have talked about it because obviously, like, I wanted him to play for England. I would have hoped him for my, you know, firstborn son to be a DJ too. But he quite rightly pointed out that he would constantly live under my shadow. He's like, you've kind of ruined DJing for me. That's what he says. You've kind of ruined DJing because I'll always just be your son and compared to you. And so, you know, he does odd. Now he's a reality TV star. He gets those kind of personality gigs.
Yeah.
And I've taught him the rudiments of mixing, but we'll see if that progresses or not. I don't think it's an avenue he really wants to do.
Fair enough. And I want to talk about, I saw on Instagram the other day, you've recently celebrated 11 years of sobriety, is that right?
I'm not going to be the poster boy for sobriety.
Yeah.
I had most fun for 32 years and left no stone unturned when it came to self-abuse and partying. And then it got to a point where it was hurting and it wasn't fun anymore and it wasn't tenable. So I stopped and it was quite hard to do. And it's not anything that I'd recommend anyone to do unless you feel you ought to, or those around you feel that you know it's a problem. But obviously, if your physical or mental health is suffering through over partying, then you do have to kind of have a word with yourself, which is what I had to do.
Yeah.
And it's been great for me. I mean, I don't think I'd be physically able to do the traveling and the late nights I do if I was still partying. So it's brought longevity to my career and possibly my life. But, like, having said that, I don't want to bang on. My advice to you kids is, like, party for as long as you can, as hard as you can for as long as you can, and then give up when it starts hurting.
That's good advice.
No, but having said that, the mental health thing is... I think it's just part of our society now that we're finally waking up to the fact that some of the doubts or fears or troubles that we've always kind of just kept buried or secret are actually an illness that you shouldn't be ashamed of, and you should be able to talk to your friends about and the world about. And if you do talk to other people about it, it can sometimes really help. I think, like homosexuality was in the Victorian times, or like dyslexia was in the 50s, in the 60s, it was just something that it wasn't talked about. And when you get it out in the open and talk about it, it helps, and it makes it less. And now, whether you're a DJ or whether you're just anyone, I think you have to be open about your mental health and talk about it.
Yeah.
And I've had problems over the years, and talking to other people has really helped. And it can be very, very serious. And obviously, there's been people around me it's taken its toll on. And you never want to think that there's that something was suppressed or not mentioned to the detriment of someone's health.
I mean, certainly some of the other DJs that we've spoken to on the podcast, like Brandon Block, etc., you know, certainly lived that life. When it starts to take its toll, it's something to start thinking about, kind of stepping back from. I mean, it is like from what we found as well, other DJs, it can be a very lonely life in terms of, like, you are sometimes on your own, travelling around the world, travelling alone in a hotel.
There are certain pressures. I don't think DJs... I mean, the whole Avicii thing triggered off whole thing of, like, you know, is it a bad, you know, lifestyle? Was that what killed him? And I think it's too simplistic to see that. But also, you look at it, it's like, yes, we do, you know, yes, it's quite glamorous, but yes, it's like lots of long hours. But when I'm not going to be the one that moans about travel or loneliness or anything to do with DJ, compared to real people who've got real jobs and their lives, you know, we shouldn't be singled out that we're potentially more likely to have problems, or that it's somehow not our fault. You know, fully aware that it's quite a weird life you live, but I don't think we can moan. And I think, but you can't hide behind it and say, well, it was, you know, DJ. You're all responsible for your own kind of mental well-being. And yeah, can't blame the pressures of DJing, darling.
You're ensconced in Brighton down here. Obviously, it's been your home for how long?
Nearly 40 years, yeah. I came down here to go to college when I was 18.
You're heavily involved in lots of community things down here as well. How important is it for you to have a sense of community and place and a base?
I think it's really important. In fact, going back to what we were talking about, DJ's mental health, that's probably one thing that's really helped me, is that I didn't live out the suitcase all the time. When I come home, I've got a very, very definite home where I feel I belong, and not just family, like Brighton is kind of my sort of wider family. And I think it's quite important, because a lot of DJs end up sort of moving to LA or something like that, and I think that would discombobulate me.
Yeah.
So I've always been a very homely person. When I come home, I've got my kids, like I said, Brighton has just become my extended family. It's a sort of two-way love affair. They like the fact that I stayed living here when I should have moved up to London, because that's what's the done thing when you become successful. And they love that I brought Zoe down here, and then I love that they love me, and then they love that I like the Albion, and then I love the Albion. It just becomes this kind of sort of reciprocal loving over the years, which is nice. And it's kind of nice, because Brighton's a sort of small enough place that everybody has probably said hello to me at some point, so that I don't get bothered. just people just like, all right, Norm. But no one makes a fuss. I'm kind of part of the furniture down here.
Yeah.
But I'm very proud of this city. I think it's a beautiful place to live. It's a very creative place. It's a very tolerant place. It's a very forward thinking place. It's full of lovely people, and I'm very proud of that. And that's why I've stayed here. And then while I'm here, I might as well get involved in what I can. And I'd like to get involved in community things and charity things and football things and. Mm. You know, not just events.
Yeah, we've just hit the hour mark on here. So we always ask for five tracks.
Oh, yes. You all know the stories behind those tracks.
Yeah, so just your card. I've written them down for you, just
good,
in case you've
forgotten.
Yeah, so based on five themes, and these go in the Spotify playlist that our listeners can listen to. Obviously, all of our guests have contributed to these. It's potentially building what we see as the perfect playlist. So you've already kind of talked about...
But also the caveat of like curating the Ibiza film, I had to change one. I was forced to change
one of my things down to...
It wasn't on Spotify. We won't mention which one was the replacement one.
Yeah, we've had a few like that as well, which is disappointing. We've already kind of mentioned the catalyst.
Yeah, so the catalyst was Robert Owens, I'll Be Your Friend. And we've told that story.
Indeed.
My go-to floor filler is the Cube Guys version of Psycho Killer.
Yeah, the Talking Heads.
Yeah, which is, yeah, David Byrne's vocal.
Yeah.
Over a kind of acid house revamp, which just, I grew up on that song.
Yeah.
And that was the song that got me into Smileys, because the cover of the Division of 12-inch in 1977 was a Smiley t-shirt.
Really?
And it's kind of ironic, but it was the first time I kind of registered the Smiley. Yeah. So that, for that reason, also, it means a lot to me. Also, the Cube Guys, I'm a really big fan of their. We've got the same kind of mind in how music should be. I play a lot of their stuff, and we're kind of pen pals. So big ups to the Cube Guys and David Byrne, and another compatriot of mine, Psycho Killer. A perfect track for soundtrack, Sunset, is Groove Armada at the River. I don't know, it requires no explanation, really, does it? Just suffice to say that I turned my own son onto it all these years later. Well, 20 years later,
yeah.
And he's 20,
yeah.
And I played it to him, and he didn't say much, but then about two nights after, he'd had a sesh, and he's like, That Groove Armada track was like, that was the tune of the sesh. It's totally in my head now. It's like, I can't get it out of my head. It's like, yes, another soul is mine. Tearjerker. Yeah, emotional songs. Immediately In and Out of My Life by One Fat Diva came to mind, simply because that's the last time I can remember spontaneously bursting into tears whilst DJing. And yeah, I hadn't played it for ages. The gist is, it's the rhythm track of Right Here, Right Now,
yeah,
which someone did a bootleg with Adiva's. Is it called In and Out of My Life? Yeah, I can't remember the original song, but it was an Adiva tune. There's an a cappella, and they put the a cappella of that over Right Here, Right Now, and it actually got an official release called One Fat Diva, spelled with a PH. In and Out of My Life, and I hadn't played it for years, and I suddenly remembered it, because it used to be really big in my crate, and I thought I'd play it, and I played it, and it was just when I was going through a difficult time in my personal life, and it was just like, all of a sudden, after playing it for 20 years, I suddenly listened to the lyrics and started singing them really loud, and the whole song came, I'd never really paid attention before, but the whole thing suddenly came alive to me. And it was suddenly, I was right in the middle of her story, and I just burst out crying whilst DJing. You know, I'm often kind of sort of brought to tears a little bit, you know. You know, there's some moments where you just like, oh. But this actually, I was actually crying. I was like, oh, God. So, yes, well done, Adiva, for taking a grown man apart like that.
Just in terms of that track, did you find it ironic in a way hearing someone sample your work back to you?
No, it was just because... because it had been part of my work, it was like, oh, that was one of my tunes within the thing, and now that's a hit, so, you know, I can play it for another 6 months in my sets. I had never stopped and listened to the lyrics of it. It was always just a tune, so I never stopped and enjoyed it as a piece of music. It was just something that I played in my sets. But then after 20 years not playing it, to put it back and hear it with a fresh pair of ears, there was something in there that I'd completely missed, which triggered quite a lot in me.
It's incredible how music can do that sometimes.
Yeah, well, that's coming back to what I was saying before about music not becoming your job.
Yeah.
It can be the most emotive. It can lift you up when you're down. It can console you when you're down. It can be the sound. You know, I always see it as just the soundtrack. If my life's a film, then music is the soundtrack. And, you know, it's the love theme. And there's the theme for each person. Most of my friends, there's a track that would always remind me of them. At least one. It's like their theme tune that I hear in my head when they see them walking down the street. And yeah, and music. I think music and smell are the two most evocative things for me in my life that can stir my emotions.
I always bore my friends with the story, oh, Matt, shut up, about the first time I heard this track, because I can always remember sometimes the first time I heard those tracks, and this DJ played it there, or I was in this club there, and just that feeling that I had. And, you know, half my friends were kind of interested, the other half are like, oh, God, he's banging on about the first time he heard something again.
It's weird, every time I've got a terrible, I really love football, but I've got a terrible head. I can't remember who we played last week. I can't remember the names of half our players. I can retain knowledge about labels and B-sides and producers, but I can't retain any football knowledge.
Yeah.
And every time anyone else says, what's the first football match you went to? I know it was Charlton Athletic versus Chester, but I don't know what the score is, what the score was, but I do know what two tunes they played at half time.
They were. Which were?
Which was David Cassidy, How Can I Be Sure? And Mouldy Old Dough like, by Lieutenant Pigeon, which was on Decca by the. Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, I can remember these. So, wow. Yeah, and that was my association with going to my first football match, yeah. Was summed up by the music that was playing, not by the score of the game.
That's incredible. And, yeah, just that magpie knowledge, I suppose, has kind of got you here today.
Hopefully, yeah. I think as a DJ, I'm not sure as a musician it does you that good, but as a DJ, it's good to be able to retain knowledge. It's a bit like playing Happy Families.
Yeah.
It's like you just remember there's something over there that would go with that, you know. It's like, yeah, we'll put that one there. So yeah, I think it probably does help. I'm quite OCD about record collecting and just generally about music and that, yeah.
How good are you at remembering a set you've just played? Like, for instance, you were playing out the other day. Can you remember exactly what you played, or is it just a kind of
no,
just happens and that's compartmentalised? That was that,
yeah,
night.
Yeah, because. Most DJing is kind of in the moment. It's just an instinct, and you're looking around at people, and then you look at your list of tunes, and then something clicks between what's going on out there and what's going on in your crate, and you make a connection and think, or that will go with that tune, and that will take them to where I want them to go next, or where they want to go next. So there's much more of a. It's just a. Like I said, it's a journey you go on together, and at the end of it, you can't necessarily remember exactly what the route was, but you do remember where you ended up. Whereas I can remember what's in the crate and how it goes and how it starts and how it ends and where the drops are. Yeah. That bit I need to retain, but what order I played them on Saturday night doesn't really matter. Unless, when you get to the arena gigs, I could probably tell you what I played at Cardiff because it was pretty much the same as what I played in Nottingham the night before. So yeah, the big shows I kind of have to stick to more of a set list, and there'll be one space where I could either play that or that. But yeah, that's therein is the difference between the two sets.
Yeah. And what would be, obviously we asked for a last tune on there.
End of the crowd. Yeah, the crowd are asking for one more, so I'm going to give them John Paul Young, Love Is In The Air. Just because I don't normally play encores. Normally I've kind of got my big finish and I'll finish with Right Here, Right Now and then Praise You. And it's like, that's it, done. I'm not a rock band. I don't do encores. But if they really refuse to go home and the promoter's like, I'll play one more, then I'll go off the beaten track. And that, yeah, Love Is In The Air is kind of that. Started at Glastonbury. Rob the Bank played it at Sunday Best.
Yeah.
At tea time on a Sunday when I'd completely lost all attachment to reality, and it took me to such a beautiful place.
It's such a joyful track.
But I don't knock it out willy nilly.
Yeah,
it only comes out on very special moments.
That's good. A good last tune. And our final question is always: we are obviously house culture, and you've been involved in kind of the culture of dance music, the wider dance music community as well, throughout your whole career. What does this culture mean to you personally, and what do you think the future of it is? Are you surprised that it's lasted this long?
I'm glad you called it house culture rather than dance culture, because dance music did get a little, after surviving in various stages of underground and slightly overground, from, you know, 70s black gay disco to the warehouses of Chicago and Detroit, and it's kind of always been survived because of that. When electronic dance music was coined, particularly by the rest of the world, not so much England, the rest of the world, they took what was ours and what was something quite sacred, and they rinsed it for money, and they bastardized it for money, not for fun, just to wring everything they could out of it. And it portrayed we'd done in a close community. It took it to a big, larger community, which is great, but they showed them the wrong bits, and they said, you know, what you should do, put on ridiculous clothing, spend tons of money on vodka and have endless bass drops and all the wrong things about it. And At first I was like, oh, it's really good that, you know, because some people are quite snooty and like, yeah, this EDM, it's not real music. I'm like, oh, come on. Is DJ culture going overground? The trickle down in terms of business is good for all of us. They can exist there. We know what we do. And, you know. But then I, over the years, I wore me down and I started to resent the fact that they were possibly distorting the perception of what we did. It's like, you know, the sort of thing. You know those jokes about, you know, the button pushing DJs who don't do anything. At first, it's like, hey, yeah, well, we know we do. And then after a while, it's like, you honestly really do think we do that, don't you? You know, it's like, oh right. And how do I look any different from, you know, that DJ who's, you know? And there was that one. Have you seen that? But wait, when will the bass drop video? And I was thinking, on the one hand, that's kind of true. That's kind of our job, is just to wind people up and just to make it so that when we do. When you do hit the drop, somebody's head will explode. I would take that as a real compliment, you know. Well, sometimes I was like, can I make people come in their pants? Can I make their heads explode? Come on, God. And on the one hand, that is all we do, and we do just press buttons. But on the other hand, if you kind of, you know, you're not necessarily satirising something, you actually might believe that that's really what is going on, and actually some of the DJs might believe that's what's going on. And then at that point, I just started, I got a bit annoyed with EDM, and I started willing it to implode on itself. And but that's not out of not wanting all those kids to have fun. It's to preserve what I hold dear, and something a scene and a community that's been evolving and growing and over generations now, and that needs kind of a little bit of protection. In the same way that, you know, champagne can only come from the Champagne region, perhaps house music, as opposed to electronic dance music, perhaps house music should only be allowed to come from those who will love it and nurture it and who are proper family. And there's a little bit of me that I've noticed that the techno family are very, at the moment, there's a kind of techno is almost becoming a religion. And I was thinking, I wonder if that's a direct reaction to EDM. It's just they want to distance themselves so much. Say, we're a proper family, you know. And to other people, our music might sound the same, but it's not. And our culture might sound the same, it's not. Our fashions, no. You know, and I can see, I've never really been much of a purist, but I'm beginning to become more purist about house music just for its preservation, because it's a beautiful thing, should be here forever.
It's an absolutely perfect sentiment to end on, I think.
Cool.
Thank you.
Sorry, my daughter.
No, yeah, sorry. It's like...
House culture.
Yes, that actually did just happen. I must admit, I was absolutely bricking it to be meeting the legendary Fatboy Slim for that chat. But as you heard, he's a lovely fella. He put us immediately at ease at his place and looked after us nicely with a great cuppa. Thanks very much, Mr. Cook. As you did hear though, the interview took place just as the first batch of coronavirus cancellations started coming through. And whilst Fatboy Slim won't be appearing at Coachella, Glastonbury or the human traffic event at Printworks he mentioned, this enforced lockdown might hopefully tempt him back into the studio. Maybe, just maybe. Speaking of tunes, you can find all of the tracks that you pick for our perfect playlist by getting onto Spotify and searching for House Culture Perfect Playlist. In there, you'll also find the other chosen ones from all of our previous guests in Season 1. It's getting pretty big now, so stick it on shuffle and turn it up loud. Once you've done that, please support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, but most importantly, leaving a review. I can't tell you how important this is. So if you like what you hear and want to hear more, jot down some kind words for us, please. We can always give you a shout out in return. Which leads me to say a huge thanks to our honourable house culture godmother, Ali. Wow. The help you've given us, guys, is beyond words, and what we owe you cannot be measured. Thank you so much. Here's to us doing loads more in the future. And if you've got this far into the podcast and still don't know what house culture is all about, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Hit up our Instagram feed at houseculturenet or follow the hashtag #TrueHouseCulture to make sure you do not miss out on any of those parties currently popping off all over the world.
And finally, you can reach out to me, Matt Rouse, directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
House Culture.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.